2,000 Years of Jewish Odysseys, Part 3, the 3rd century, as those were sponsored by Becky Navi Katz, Ili Nishmas, Yona Ben, Rabbi Arileib, and we, as always, thank them for their sponsorship. Rabbi Yehuda Anossi died in the 190s, and with his death, an era ended. There's one element of the era the Mishnah mentions in Sota, Daf Mem Testament Aleph, Mishneis Rebbe, Botlo Anova V'Yiras Chet. When Rebbe died, there was no one of such pure humility and fear of sin as Rebbe was, despite his greatness in both Torah and in political leadership. His Anova was pure. He had a great sense of self, his place in the world vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as well as Yiras Chet, but more relevant, Tfilos. Rav, many hold, was the one who instituted that we say Aleinu after every Tfilah. Rav son, they were the end of the Mishnah. So Rashi says the end of the Mishnah, Sof Tanoim. We'll get back to that in a moment. And Rashi explains, Ad Yemehen Omru Ishes Devar V'Beis HaMedrash. Until their time, a person would come to the Beis HaMedrash and say what he had to say. V'Hayu Talmidim Garsim Shmua Shmu Levado. And the Talmidim, the students of the Beis HaMedrash, would learn each teaching individually, separately. V'Lo Hayu Masechtos Zduros. And there was no order to any of the learning. Someone would say a teaching in one area, and the others would discuss it and memorize it. They move on to another area. V'sider v'kibetz ala seder. And what Rebbe did is he arranged everything in a particular order. V'hen kilu ha'omur b'darah shelefneim v'sidus mesechtos. And they gathered it all together, everything from the prior generations, and arranged it in tractates. V'achareihem lo yosifu ela me'at. Rashi says, and thereafter was added very little. Added very little. Of course, the discussions on what Rebbe did went on, well, go on until today. And the Mishnah became the basic framework in which the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, would be discussed, and therefore it included every topic that in some way impacted on Jewish life, both practical, meaning our daily lives, tefillah, Shabbos, Yom Tov, business, etc., as well as areas that even then were already less practical, like the laws of Kadoshim or the laws of the Avod in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, as we discussed last time, some say Rebbe put it in its final written form and it was published in his lifetime. Others maintain it wasn't published until some 20 years after his death, but he arranged it orally. So already in his time, that became the structure in which Torah would be discussed. By the beginning of the 3rd century of the Common Era, other works were taking shape, the products of Rebbe's disciples that would help clarify and delineate the boundaries of the Mishnah itself. Now the question is, how did Rebbe choose which opinions to incorporate in the Mishnah? We mentioned a few weeks ago, just because Beis Hillel said one thing and Beis Shammai said another thing doesn't mean that there was a third bias that didn't say a third thing. So how did Rebbe just choose between the two or three opinions that he would? So Rebbe essentially chose the mainstream opinions, even if already one opinion was rejected in practice. That itself clarified the nature of the discussion. So in fact, in subsequent years, the arguments would be more constricted than they otherwise would be, and would be able to determine from the two opinions in the Mishnah what exactly they're arguing about. What is the point at issue? That cannot be recorded, because then the Mishnah would be voluminous, as it is today, because we did eventually record some of the discussions in the Talmud and then on into the Rishonim and Achronim. The Mishnah as written is really just a small volume. The very first elucidation of the Mishnah was published in the early part of the 3rd century, and that's the Tosefta. The Tosefta of Reb Chiya, another great Talmud of Reb Yehuda Anossi, who came from Bavel, and the Tosefta of Reb Oshaya HaGadol, the great Reb Oshaya, who really was a tremendously great figure about whom we almost never speak about, because Reb Chiya became famous because of his nephew, as we'll discuss. Reb Oshaya himself had a yeshiva in Caesarea, in the seat of the Roman government there, and nonetheless there he taught Torah. But the Gemara says very frequently, Tanei Reb Chiya, Tanei Reb Oshaya. This is what they discussed. Now the Tosefta followed the order of the Mishnah and essentially were elaborations, as it sounds, Tosefta, that which is added, a supplement to the Mishnah. Outside the school of Rebbe and his Talmidim were also separate teachings that were compiled, and they were known as Braisos, from the word bar, bara, meaning outside. But they were not as authoritative as the Mishnah or the Tosefta, but were very useful in clarifying the intent of the Mishnah. In fact, much of the subsequent 3 centuries of Talmud Torah are consumed with such discussions of the Mishnah, comparing its words to a brisa, sometimes challenging it. Zero minhu, they bring a brisa from somewhere else. Nesave, they bring a brisa that challenges a statement that Tana had made, all of which, the purpose of which was to extract the principle upon the machlokas, upon which the machlokas was centered, so that it could provide guidance for the future. Now that principle, known later as the svara or the chakira, which is the Gemara's logic or the Gemara's hypothesis or the Gemara's thought process in analyzing a problem, those svaros, those chakiros, which were determined by comparing the opinions in the Mishnah against each other or against the Braisa or Tosefta, that would provide the basic framework for Talmud Torah in those days, and as we'll discuss in a few weeks, that will be memorialized in the 5th century in the Gemara. Now others call, Rashi uses this expression in Chulin, others call the Tosefta Braisos as well. It is just anything which is outside the Mishnah became a Baraisa, something outside. So they just attribute the Baraisos to Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Shaya HaGadol, but as a technical matter, they authored the Tosefta and the Braisos were something else. Now go back to that Gemara in Bab Metzia, Daf Hei Vav Hav Aleph, Rebbe Reb Nosson Sof Mishnah. That introduces another demarcation in Jewish life, an important one. Rebbe and Reb Nosson were Sof Tanoim, the end of the period of the Tanoim, which had gone back almost 6 centuries to the time of Shimon HaTzadik. The Tanoim were literally teachers, and the beginning of the next era in Jewish life of 3 centuries of Amoraim, and Amora is literally an interpreter. So the process of uncovering the essential points of the Mishnah, that would be the work of the Amoraim. So they do not originate, but they discuss at length the various issues to extract the principle that they could then apply to a new situation that would arise. So the Amorim were limited in the sense that they cannot argue with a Tana. In fact, whatever they would assert, if it seemed new, would be rejected unless they could corroborate it with a reference to a Tana. And that's the phrase you find again and again in the Gemara, Hu de Omar ki hai Tana. He, this Amora, said like that Tana, whether in a Mishnah or a Braisa or a Tosefta, because otherwise he's just making it up, and that you can't do. That they had no right to do. Why not? Why couldn't an Amora argue with a Tana? It's a question that's always asked. So I gave a shiur on this topic about 6 months ago on Shabbos. It's not taped. But just to be brief, the most straightforward explanation was given by the Meitzer d'Iluy of Shlomo Palachek, one of the great Talmidim of Reb Chaim, who said that it's not that the Amorim were not as bright as the Tanaim. That we can never say. Nor will we ever say categorically the Tanaim are always right, and therefore someone of a later generation cannot disagree. That we wouldn't say. The Meitzer d'Iluy said it was just a practical measure to limit the scope of machlokos, of disputes. Otherwise, a Rav today, I say, I disagree with the Rambam, I disagree with Rava. Why is his opinion better than mine? There are people who do say that, but that's outside the system of halacha. That's unacceptable. What the Meitzer d'Iluy says, there was this demarcation between the period of the Tanaim and Amora could not argue on a Tana because otherwise there'd be no finality, there'd be no clarity. The disputes would be open-ended, never resolved, and the Torah itself would become much more fluid than it should be. So the demarcation was somewhat arbitrary, but nonetheless it did exist. Rebbe Reb Nosson Sof Mishnah, of course, it's not as if it happened at a particular date and time. You know, 12 noon on this day, that's the end of the Tanoim, and now we'll begin the period of the Amoraim. It happened over a generation, so there are transitional figures. Same thing happened, by the way, with the, we'll see, the Saboroim and the Gaonim and the Rishonim and the Acharonim, even down to our day, where distinctions are made between the early Acharonim and the later Acharonim too. We'll get back to the transitional figures in a few moments. The greatest transition of the 3rd century of the Common Era, and one that's really transformed Jewish life until today, was the shift of the center of Jewish life away from Israel and to the exile, especially now Babel. Israel would not again become the center of Jewish life until modern times, if indeed it is. And if it is, it only happened the last 10 years or so, where the center of Jewish life, I'm not talking about majority of the population, which it might not have yet, but probably will have in another decade or two, but the place to which Jews turn for their spiritual needs. If it's happened, it's happened only recently, that Israel has begun to provide that service. But with the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi comes the rise of the Golus, and even the primacy of the Golus in our world. Think about it. After the first Churban, the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, so we were exiled to Bavel, and although that community existed from then through this period of time and for centuries hence, after the first Churban, the return to Israel was always anticipated. Now that changed. And the hope of retaining a vibrant Jewish life in Israel faded in the 3rd century. So for many centuries, while the community in Israel was central, we know very little about Jewish life in Bavel.
Nothing,
but we know little. The Torah center remained in Israel, even with the Churban of the Romans. There were a few Tanoim who lived in Bavel, but most lived in Israel. The Mishnah quotes very little Torah outside of Israel. Notwithstanding that, as we learned, Bavel regularly revitalized Torah study in the land of Israel. Remember we quoted the Gemara in Sukkot, Daf Chaf Amud Aleph, that hill had come when Torah was in somewhat the languid state in Israel, and so too now. Chozov in Ishtakho, Olu Rebchia Ubano V'Yisadua. When the Torah again began, the Torah study began to slacken off, so Rebchia and his children came from Bavel, and they reinvigorated the study of Torah. Rebchia headed Rebbe's yeshiva in Tzipori after he died, and began the process of teaching Torah that was based on the Mishnah. Now, part of this decline in the land of Israel, as always, was political in nature. Rebbe was succeeded by Rav Gamliel III. It's not that we use, you know, senior, junior, third, fourth, but he was the third Rav Gamliel since Hillel's time. He's known as Rav Gamliel III. He succeeded his father, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He served just a few years during a time of great instability in Rome. There was a succession of emperors in Rome in the first few decades of the 3rd century, and they were each summarily assassinated by their successors. In fact, it was a time of great instability. During the 3rd century, close to 24 Roman emperors served. So do the math. No one really served more than a few years. There's not a very high life expectancy. Consequently, local rulers increased their powers. The central Roman government was always weak. It always had new people taking over. And therefore, the local rulers were ruthless. Ruthless physically and ruthless financially, imposing very harsh confiscatory taxes on the people to just augment their own wealth. Rav Gamliel was succeeded by his son, Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya, called Nisiya, the Aramaic, just to distinguish from his grandfather, and the Galil, where Chia had a yeshiva following Rebbe, and Rabbi Yanai had a yeshiva elsewhere. The Galil suffered from actual famine. Famine because of the terrible economy, and famine because food supplies were regularly seized by the Roman garrisons stationed there or en route to the Eastern Front wars. The Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Kuf Mem Hei Amud Beis, just to give us a little flavor of the times, you know, what Yom Tov was. obviously Jews, like today, would stock up on food before the regalim. They had a festive time. Amar Yitzchak, Eimlecha kol regel v'regel shel basa b'leshas l'tzipore. In that era, the second and third centuries of the decades of the third century, there was not one regel where a Roman garrison, troops, did not pass through and ravage the town of all the food that they'd prepared for Yom Tov. So famine resulted. It was very hard to live, but they tried. And one way, as Jews always did, trying to overcome difficult financial hardships, was to emphasize the primacy of Talmud Torah as the secret to Jewish survival. The Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Kuf Yud Tesamid Beis, Omer Shlokish Mishum Yehuda Nisiya. So these two statements come from the Yehuda Nisiya, Rebbe's grandson. Ein ha'olam iskayim ela b'shvil hevel tinokos v'beis rabban. The whole world endures, survives, only because of the breath of the young children studying Torah in school. They sustain the world. And Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya added, Ein mevatlin tinokos shel beis rabban, afil l'binyan beis hamikdash. We don't cancel school for young children, their Torah studies, even to build the beis hamikdash. Very interesting. Now we cancel school if it rains heavily. Well, we send them to a demonstration somewhere. They have a day in the mountains. Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya said, even to build a Beis HaMikdash. Strange if you think about it, but one thing that it demonstrates, of course, the greatness of Talmud Torah, but also how the thoughts of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash had receded at that point already from Jewish consciousness. So that really is the primacy of Talmud Torah. Even to build a Beis HaMikdash, we wouldn't cancel school. Reb Chia, I mentioned, was a native Babylonian. He saw a different future ahead. In fact, he saw the future in Bavel. So Gemara says in Pesachim Daf Pezayin and Beis, Tani Reb Chia, one of his brisos, quotes a pasuk in Iyov, Elokim hevin darko v'hu yadas mekomo. God understood the path and he knew its place. What place? Yodea HaKadosh Baruch Hu Es Yisrael She'enon Yecholim L'kabal Gzeira Shel Romiyim. God knew that we would never be able to withstand the decrees of the Romans. Lefichach, Higla Osam LeBavel. That's why God exiled us to Bavel, which was a more pleasant, hospitable environment. In this, he was prescient. In one disagreement that he had with Rebbe Yehuda Nasi was Gozer, he decreed, Shelo Yeshana LeTamidim Bashuk. You're not allowed to teach students in the marketplace. The Gemara Mo'edkan Daf Tezayin Amid Aleph. So the Mefarshim understand it, not the marketplace that you can't teach Torah in Cedar Lane. Because the Gemara says that Rebbe taught his sons by Shuk anyway. So the Mefarshim explain, what is the Shuk? The Shuk means the world. Rebbe said you can't teach Torah out in the world. Torah has to remain in Eretz Yisrael. But Chia disagreed. And if Torah is not going to be taught in the world where the Jews are, it's not going to survive. Rebbe's hope was that Jews would come back from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael to learn Torah and then go back. Reb Chia said that won't work. And his own nephew went back to Bavel and established a great yeshiva there. Now why Bavel of all places? So the Gemara there in Pesachim continues. Reb Chanina Amar Reb Meshachar of Lashonam Lashon Torah, because the language there, Aramaic, is similar to Hebrew. Reb Yochanan Amar Reb Meshach Shigron Levei Siman, that God returned us to the birthplace of Avram, sent us back where we had roots. Bavel was a relatively homogeneous environment for Jews, if not, maybe better said, a homologous environment for Jews, but certainly was more compatible than anywhere else, although the climate was unpleasant. You look how the soldiers endure life in the summer in Iraq, and during the rainy season, it is unpleasant. The rivers were always overflowing, and it was just an unpleasant climate. And although grinding poverty was the norm in Bavel, there the Torah took root for a number of reasons. Firstly, Rome was almost never a problem, just briefly. Jews were allowed to live. Nor was Christianity a problem there. Nor was there a Greek-influenced culture that would entice the Jews, like as such as had enticed the Jews of the land of Israel. So Jews settled in Bavel, settled in the sense that Torah says at the end of Vayigash about Mitzrayim, Vayochazu bo, they were gripped by it. And Babel became a natural home for Jews, even extolled as a homeland for Jews, remarkably commemorated in Rabbi Yehuda's statement at the bottom of Kuf Yud Amud Beis in Ksubos. Rabbi Yehuda lived at the end of the 3rd century. Kol ha'olam mi-Bavel Eretz Yisrael over Basay. A person who ascends from Babel to go back to Eretz Yisrael violates a mitzvah in the Torah, because God sent us to Babel to live as part of the punishment of exile. Nonetheless, some left, some always left, like Reb Yehuda's student Reb Zero, triggered this discussion in Gemara there. Reb Zero was later famous for saying, Avira d'Eretz Yisrael Machakim, that the atmosphere in Eretz Yisrael makes one wise, and that even the Sicha B'Telo, the idle conversation of Bnei Eretz Yisrael, that too is Torah. That's Reb Zero. Reb Zero was a Babylonian who had gone back to Israel to learn and to live. In Babel, it should be all very familiar to us. Jews were very productive. Farmers, artisans, merchants, businessmen, even government officials. All the occupations whose halachic issues we find discussed in the Talmud. And there was considerable traffic between Babel and Eretz Yisrael. Talmidei Chachamim, the scholars, went back and forth. You find the Gemara says, Shalchu mitam, they send from there to Babel, halachic guidance or a new teaching, who have been Ma'arava Amre, in Israel they said such and such. There was also regular Aliyah L'Regel. Jews went from Babel to celebrate Yom Tov, the Regalim, in Yerushalayim. So in that sense, again, it's a type of exile that's very familiar to us, of course. It also had its dangers. For example, it was in this century that Chazal instituted in Ma'ariv the saying of Baruch Hashem L'Olam, Amen V'Amen, a long paragraph of miscellaneous psukim after the brachos of Ma'ariv and before the Shmoneh Esrei. Only in the exile, never in Israel. Why? For fear that otherwise latecomers, and they're always latecomers, would have to walk home from shul alone. And in the Golus, it was always a danger, but that's a purely Golus phenomenon. In Israel, it's never recited. But that Baruch Hashem L'Olam, Amen V'Amen, we recite until today. Just like Rebbe's death ended the year of Tanoim, the death of his grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya, in 228, ended another critical era in Jewish life that has yet to be restored. Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya was the last person accepted by all Jews as the Nasi. All Jews saw him as the leader. Even the Sanhedrin, if it continued to exist another 130 years or so, would lose its primacy. So already in the first third, or towards the end of the first third of the third century, the Rabbanim in Babel asserted their own authority. Never again would Jews be bound by one universal halachic authority, a situation that endures until today. Now, if you think it's not controversial, it still is controversial. Witness the old dispute in the last year and a half, about Geirus in Israel and how it should or should not affect us here. But many people here want to say, well, if they, the Rabbanut, are going to accept or reject, then we have to kowtow to them. And many others say, who appointed them as our leaders? That ended at the time in 228 when the Jews of Babel asserted their own authority and had their own Torah scholars. So there are interactions, and certainly there are mutual needs. But that one group of Rabbonim in one country can dictate to Jews in another country, that ended in the 3rd century. Some want to restore it, usually the ones who are most powerful. But there's always Jews have their own minds. So never again would Jews be bound by one halachic authority, and of course that awaits the reinstitution of the Sanhedrin. One reason was that Babel had its own institution of the Reish Galusa. The Reish Galusa was a descendant of David HaMelech through the paternal line. Hillel and his chain, the base Hillel, were descendants of David HaMelech through the maternal line. So therefore, the Reish Galus had a greater chashivus in that sense. Now, some of the Reish Galusa were not of the greatest caliber, but many of them were very fine Talmidei Chachamim, and since Jews were mostly autonomous in Babel, the Reish Galusa wielded tremendous temporal power of taxation, of a judiciary, of police enforcement, And the Gemara makes their respective power bases very clear in Sanhedrin Daf Hey Amud Aleph. Lo Yosu Shevet Miyehuda, the rod shall not depart from Yehuda. This is Yaakov's bracha to Yehuda, the end of in Vayechi. Elu Rosh HaGoliel Shebebavel. These are the exilarchs, the leaders of the exile in Bavel. Sharodin Es Yisrael B'Shevet, that they rule the people with a stick. Umachokek Mibein Raglav, a scepter between his legs. Elu B'nei Bonav Shel Hillel. These are Hillel's descendants. Shemilamdim Torah Barabim. They teach Torah publicly. You see the difference in the Gemara. In Bavel, they carried a big stick. They clopped people, literally, if they didn't obey. In Israel, their only means of authority was through the Torah, through spiritual majesty. So in Israel, Torah was the major source of power. In Bavel, it was the Reish Galusa. When the Reish Galusa was a pious Jew, allied with the heads of the yeshivas, then you see why the Jews of Bavel would no longer look to the Sanhedrin for their guidance, but to their own Rabbanim, including the greatest among them, and probably the pivotal Jewish figure in this century. His name was Abba ben Abo. He earned the nickname Abba Aricha. Abba Aricha, Abba the Tall. He was very tall. They called him the Tall One. And he was known to us as Rav. Rav in the Gemara. Now, everyone in the YU world is accustomed to calling Rabbi Soloveitchik the Rav. In Israel, when you hear the phrase, the word Harav, it's a reference to Marana Rav Kook. But before there was the Rav and Harav, it was just Rav. Rav was a transitional figure, a very close Talmud of Rebbe, the nephew of Reb Chiya that I mentioned earlier. He was originally a Bavli, but he spent most of his life in Israel. He had one early attempt to resettle in Bavel that failed. Eventually he did return to Bavel under very strange circumstances. Now, of course, he's a tremendous Talmud Chacham. Everybody recognized that. He's a strong personality, as most great leaders are, but he was an Onav as well. So Gemara tells a story that there in Sanhedrin Daf Hamed Aleph that Rebbe gave smicha. So three types of smichas existed then. Yor, like we have today, of Isser V'Heter. Yod and Yod, like we have today, of Mamanus. And Yatir B'Choros Yatir, which is the highest level, giving a person the right to ascertain which blemishes on a Bechor disqualify that animal that can be used for general purposes. So Rebbe gave smicha of Yorah, Yodin, and Yatir to Rabba Bar Bar Chana before Rabba went to Bavel, but not to his cousin Rav. Rav was a cousin of Rabba Bar Bar Chana. Why not? So the Gemara says one opinion is that Rebbe wanted to give Rabba Bar Bar Chana a greater distinction because Rav was a renowned Talmud Chacham. And if you spoke to him, you'd realize he's a great Talmud Chacham. Rabba, not as much. So therefore, it adds to his resume if he had the smich of Yatir Becharos Yatir. Others say that in the Gemara, the other opinion is that Rav was such a great Talmud Chacham that he would permit things that others might misconstrue. In any event, Rebbe refused and Rav took offense. And when Rav Gamliel III refused because his father hadn't, then Rav just left and went to Bavel. Now keep in mind, Rav was one of Rebbe's greatest Talmidim, and the bridge between these two eras of the Tanum and Amoraim. So he was the first of the Amoraim, it's called the first generation of Amoraim in Bavel, but he was a Tana as well. The Gemara says several times, Rav, Tana who, Poli? That Rav could issue his own opinions because he was a Tana too. Rav, like Rebbe, was also very prolific. And he compiled and edited what became known, really the magnum opus of the 3rd century CE, the Medrash Halacha. The Medrash Halacha links the deductions of the Torah Shebal Peh to the Psukim, in a way, I guess, similar to what the Torah Tanima did in the last century, but in a much more elaborate sense. Rav edited and compiled the Mechilta on Shmos, the Sifra, the Taras Kohanim on Vayikra, the Sifrei on Bamidbar and Dvarim, as well as his own Tosefta. Rav also formalized, probably more than any person since, our tefillos. Rav many hold was the one who instituted that we say Aleinu after every tefillah. Rav composed, the Gemara says openly, the tefillah of Atodienu that we say when Motzei Shabbos is a Yom Tov. Most importantly, and what I found, this I hadn't heard before, it's a Yerushalmi, Rav composed the long brachos that we say on Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros. The psukim are always recited, but Rav drafted Ata Zocher, Masayola, Mata Neglesa, Banan Kvodecho. He put those psukim in a very poetic, thematic context, which from then until now is at the heart of our machzor on Rosh Hashanah. Most famous for us is Tfilas Rav. Gemara says in Brachos Daf Yud Zayin Amud Beis, a tefillah he would say every day, beginning Yiratzon Lefanecha, Hashem Elokim Hakeinu Seinu, Shetiten Lanu Chaim Arukim, Chaim Shel Shalom, Chaim Shel Tova, which of course he said every day, we say as Birkas HaChodesh, once a month, we say Tfilas Rav. In fact, you find old Sidurim, it's one of the great mistakes that you find in Jewish life. After the end, the Amale Mishal Sabena Latova, Omein Selo, before Omein Selo would say, Bezchus Tfilas Rav, alright? Until a few centuries ago, some Chacham, a printer, said, what's Rav? It's a mistake. He thought it should say, Bezchus Tfilas Rabim, because the whole community is davening. So therefore the schus of a tefillah b'tzibur, all these brachas should come true. But that was an error. It's a printer's mistake that sidurim still have, some of them, b'schus tefillas rabim. What was added at the end is b'schus tefillas rav, because this birkas hachodesh was Rav's tefillah that he recited every day. Now, of course, when he came to Bavel, Bavel wasn't a spiritual vacuum that was waiting for him. No place is, although there is a statement in the Gemara that Rav thought it was. There were great leaders in Bavel. Harno, not as well known to us as his successor, was the Rosh Yeshiva Nehardo. Nehardo was an ancient Babylonian city, a Jewish city, we'll get back to a little later. And the better known Shmuel, who was the co-Rosh Yeshiva in Nehardo, and a very, very famous, worldly, to be anachronistic, a Renaissance figure. Shmuel was a doctor, a physician, who the Gemara records some of his medical advice, which is, much of it is still relevant till today. He was a fanatic about bathing and hygiene in order to ward off bacteria and disease. The Gemara had even some of his formulas for medications. The Chachamim and the non-Jews of the time would seek him out for his potions and ointments that would be used. And he said once, Gemara says that someone asked him for a salve, and he said, you're better off bathing every day. It's better than any ointment I can give you. He was also an astronomer, well known as an astronomer. So Gemara says that he said that the pathways of the heavens are as familiar to him. He knows them as well as he knows the streets of Nardo. Shmuel composed a calendar. Now, there are a few times in the 3rd century where the Romans prevented Jews from declaring the Rosh Chodesh in Israel. They had to run to Bavel to do it. So Shmuel, very prescient, this we'll get to next week, he drafted a 60-year calendar that would include most of the Yom Tovim of the 3rd century, the Common Era, in order to avoid situations where the Sanhedrin might not be able to get out and declare the Rosh Chodesh. Shmuel calculated the length of the solar year just on his own knowledge, his own investigation. It's a second or two off to what NASA calculates it today. A tremendous gone. He was also a wealthy businessman, Shmuel, so he's a tremendous figure. He wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva, though. He was the second in command to Karno. Rav came to Nardo, which was the major Jewish city, and he just came. So his first position was the Meturgamon to Rav Shelo at the weekly Sidra. Now, just to clarify, in Eretz Yisrael, the places of learning were called Mesiftos or Yeshivos, as they are today. Bavel, Lacha Lo Kavod, Eretz Yisrael, to pay their honor and deference to the land of Israel, they didn't call their house of Torah study Yeshivos, they called them Sidros. So people would come to the Sidro, especially to hear every week an exposition on the Sidro with a commentary of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, the way it worked is that the lecturer would speak in Hebrew, quoting the psukim, and then giving the explanation of Torah Shebal Peh, and the Meturgamon would translate it into Aramaic, and I guess have to yell a little louder than the speaker did to transmit the information to the people. In fact, Kriyas HaTorah was that way. They'd read a pasuk, and then the Meturgamon would translate the pasuk into Aramaic. I don't think that would go over well today if we did that. Now, the Meturgamon was just supposed to convey the ideas of the lecturer in a different language. When Rav began inserting his own thoughts, Rav Shela fired him. Now, at this time, Rav came to Bavel. He was already in his 60s. He was an older man. Rav was then appointed by the Reish Galusa as the supervisor of weights and measures in Nardot. It was a prestigious appointment. But when he refused other tasks, the Reish Galusa fired him and even threw him in jail for a short period of time. Yerushalmi says in Baba Basra, that's the type of authority they had. He was soon released and wisely left Nardot altogether. Now, his situation improved under a new Reish Galusa, one of those Reish Galusa who renowned Tamid HaChachamim as the famous Mar Ukva. Mar Ukva was famous for his knowledge of Torah and for his extreme generosity. Reference the stories in the Gemara Ksuva, Stav Samach Zayin, Amud Beis. He was very wealthy, as the Reish Galusa were, and he gave away enormous sums of money to the poor on a constant basis. One of the stories the Gemara says there is his tactic. He would do it anonymously. He would just walk late at night and throw bags of money into the house of the poor and then run off. If you ever see my door open at night, that's what I'm hoping for too. Once the poor got wise, they wanted to know who was doing it. So he threw the money into the door, and the door opened, and Mar Ukva ran into a furnace in order to hide, scalding his feet. And his wife came with rags to be able to walk out, so not to burn himself, just so as not to embarrass the poor. That was the Reish Galusa. So he made Rav's life a little easier as well. Rav went, established the yeshiva in Hutzal. Hutzal was another famous Jewish town. The Gemara says, Megillah Daf Chav Tes Amud Aleph uses the shul in Hutzal as proof that the Shekhinah accompanied the Jewish people even in exile. There he established the yeshiva. When Rav Shela died, Shmuel succeeded him as Rosh Hashiva Nardah. Rav then moved to Surah, and he founded the famous yeshiva in Surah that would exist for more than 800 years through the time of Rav Haigon. There as well, in Surah, Rav established a tradition known as the Yarchei Kala. We have it until today, really, in many places. Every month of Adar and month of Elul, Jews would flock to hear Divrei Torah to prepare for the Yom Narom, prepare for Pesach, and Yom Tovim rather, prepare for Pesach and prepare for the Yom Narom. Thousands of Jews took off work in Adar and in Elul. And then they're taking off work in Nisan and in Tishrei. There's a pattern developing. But thousands would come, so many, the Gemara says, that at the end of the day's lectures, when they would stand up, the dust would fill the room so much it would block the light of the sun. That's the extent to which the Yarchei Kala became very popular. By the time Rav died in 247, just a few years before Shmuel died, Surah and Nardot were the major yeshivas in Bavel, greater than anything you find in Eretz Yisrael. Shmuel was succeeded in Nardot by Rav Nachman, and then by Rav Sheshes, and soon Nardot would cease to exist, as we'll get back to. Now, Rav and Shmuel were friendly rivals, at first rivals, then they became havrusos, as well as heads of different yeshivas, but together they solidified the tradition of Talmudic discussions that would culminate in the publication of the Gemara. Rav himself, and maybe this is why he was called Rav, had thousands, literally thousands of Talmidim. Thousands! Rav is quoted by 167 different Amoraim, quote statements in the name of Rav. And that's just a fraction of the number of Talmidim that he had. 167. So some do favors to us. Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, etc. But 167 different Amaroim quoted him. He and Shmuel disagreed on hundreds of matters, but Chazal adopted a shorthand. Halacha Kerav Visurei Ukishmuel B'Mamoneh. Shmuel, of course, had lived in Bavel much longer than Rav, so therefore if they disputed on an area of civil law, halacha was like Shmuel practically. For an area of Isser v'Heter, like Kashrus for example, or Shabbos, then the halacha was like Rav. Shmuel also is famous for us for institutionalizing in Bavel, and until today, the notion of Dina d'Rechus Adina, that the law of the land is law. That's a statement of Shmuel. That means that in limited cases, we follow the law of the land where it comes to commercial custom. We're obligated in terms of taxation, currency laws, etc. Bavel really was a prototype for the exile. The exiles we grew to know it. Long periods of stability punctuated by spurts of relentless persecution. So, for example, in 216, Bava was briefly conquered by Rome, all told for less than a decade, but in the late 220s, Rome was expelled and Bava was reconquered after a civil war between rival Parthian groups by a new dynasty, the famous Sasanian dynasty, that decided to strengthen the central government by imposing a single religion on everyone. And this is really the darkest time of the 3rd century CE. This led to Bavel's rule by a fanatical Zoroastrian sect, fire worshippers, whose decrees produced a number of famous innovations in halacha, all in the 230s, really. So, for example, the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is, of course, the light outside. That's Pesumei Nisa. That's how the Nes, the miracle, is publicized. The Gemara says in Shabbos Achof Alfim and Beis, Uvishas HaSakana, in a time of danger, Manichol Shulchano V'dayo. It's enough to keep it on your table inside the house, and that suffices. What's the danger? So Rashi says, that's the danger here. The Parthians decreed on certain days you can only light fire in their houses of idolatry. So you couldn't light Hanukkah candles outside. Since then, since the 230s, most Jews light indoors. Or the Gemara Shabbos stuff, Memhe Amad Aleph, Bo Minei Darav, they asked Rav this question. Are you allowed, if they had no fear in a particular locale of the Parthians, of the Zoroastrians, are you allowed to light your Hanukkah menorah outside Friday night, and then if you see some Parthians coming, to take it inside? Where is it muktzah? So Rav said, Shachar Dami, you could take it inside. Shasad Chak, shiny. It's an emergency, you could take it in. Or, Gemara is another story in Gittin, Daf Tezzainim and Beis. Rabbi Barbrachana was discussing some Indian of Gittin. Adahochi Osu Chabora, one of the priests of the Zoroastrian saying, Shokol Shrogami Kamayhu. And he took the lamp out of their room, left them in the dark. They were a little strange. They had the fire worship. They left them in the dark because they couldn't have light outside. Just took their lamp outside. Omar, so Rabbi Barbrachana said, Rachmana, God, O betulach debar Esav, better to be in your shadow or in the shadow of the descendants of Esav, meaning Rome, as opposed to Bavel. So Gemara asks, how could that be? Lamemra, the Aramoi Malu Miparsav, it's better than the Romans and the Persians. How could that be? I quoted Reb Chiya before, that God's intention was, he knew we couldn't withstand the decrees of Rome, so he sent us to Bavel. Lokasha, Homekame Denisu Chabore Le Bavel, Ho Le Basar Deosu Chabore Le Bavel. That's before the Chaborim, those Zoroastrian priests, came to Bavel, then it was good. But after they came, then it was even worse. So the Gemara says, Yevamos Taf Samach Gimel Beis, it sounds funny, but it's really chilling. Omer Le B'yochan, the such a B'yochan was in Israel. Osu Chabore Le Bavel. The Zoroastrian priests have come to Bavel. Shoga Nofel, he fell out of his chair, faint. Because now we saw that not only are they suffering from the Romans in Israel, but now they're suffering from the Persians in Bavel. And then there's no hope. Omrulay, they said to him, Mikable Shochado, they take bribes, these Saborim. Tarich Yosef, he sat up and got back in his seat. If they take bribes, then there's something to do, we'll be able to deal with them. This period of persecution lasted just very briefly, relatively. It's hard to live through it, 10, 11 years old though. In the year 241, a new king assumed power, another Zoroastrian king named Shapur the First. In the Gemara he's called Shavur Malka. Shavur Malka, Shapur the First, was very refined, very intelligent. He befriended Shmuel, Shmuel befriended him, and the Gemara is replete with their discussions of Torah and questions that he had and praise of his benevolence. It's similar to Rebbe and Antoninus. It happened at the end of the previous century. Shmuel, for example, the Gemara records in Sukkah, would invite Shmuel Malka to Simchas Beis HaShoeva on Sukkos and entertain him by juggling 8 glasses of wine in front of him without spilling a drop. Yes, go try that at home tonight, preferably over a white carpeted floor. Now, at the end, the very end of Maseches Avodah Zarah, the Gemara has a beautiful story. Mar Yehuda and Bati Bar Tove, at the end of Avodah Zarah, it's Ayin Zayin Mabez, Ayin Vav Mabez in Avodah Zarah. Mar Yehuda and Bati Bar Tove were sitting with Shvur Malka in his palace, a social event. Aisu lekomaihu esrogo. They brought an esrog to Shmur Malko. So he took a knife, he cut himself a piece, then he cut a piece and gave a piece to Bate Bartove, and then he kashered the knife. How do you kasher a knife? You stick it in hot earth 10 times. Hagar dotsa sar zimri ba'ara. He plunged the knife into hot earth 10 times to kasher it, and then he cut off a piece of the esrog, the sharp substance, and gave it to Mar Yehuda. But the Bartuve said to him, I'm also Jewish. Why did you kasher the knife before you served him, and not before you served me? Omar Lay, Mar Kinli Bigave, Mar Lo Kinli Bigave. I knew he was observant. I didn't know you were observant. Why didn't he know? The last words of Gemara Avodah Zarah, Ikeda Amrei, Omar Lay, Idkar my Avadet Ba'urta. I know what happened last night. So Rashi says, Persian hospitality was to send a woman to their guests. So Mar Yehuda was sent a woman, and he politely declined. Bati Bar Tuve accepted a woman, and he accepted the woman. The woman spent the night with them. So Shmuel Malka said, I know what happened last night. That's when he's makbid on kashrus, he's makbid on arayos. You're not makbid on arayos, you're probably not makbid on kashrus either. In Bavel, that was the norm, rather than the exception. Narda, as a city, was destroyed in 259, didn't have to do with us, it was conquered in war. Narda had been the first city settled in Bavel after the first, even before the first Korban. It was the residence of Yechonya Melch Yudah. Some of the Nevi'im lived there. So all told, Narda had a run of 700 years as a Jewish city. Once Narda was destroyed, a new yeshiva opened under Rav Yehuda, the famous Rav Yehuda, Shmuel and Rav's Talmud, under his tutelage in Pumbedisa. That's when that word enters our lexicon. And Sura and Pumbedisa would remain the main Babylonian yeshivas until the 11th century, when Rav died in 247, Rav Huna became Rosh Yeshiva in Sura for 40 years, and then ending the century, he was followed by Rav Chista. Meanwhile, back in the Holy Land, life was in decline, but not at all dormant. And great historic figures emerged, despite everything, as leaders and teachers of Torah, primarily Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was another famous Talmud of Rebbe. In Rebbe's older years, the Gemara says, just to illustrate the difference, Rabbi Yochanan sat 17 rows behind Rav. So the further back you sat, the younger you were, the same thing here, the younger you were, and the newer Talmud that you were. See, he was 17 rows in back of Rav. Rabbi Yochanan became Rebbe's spiritual successor in the Galil. In fact, the Gemara says that was Rebbe's prophecy to him. He was also a primary disciple of Rebbe Shaya in Caesarea. He, Rabbi Yochanan, established a yeshiva in Tveria, and that in his lifetime became the locus of the Sanhedrin as well. After the death of Rabbi Yehuda Nisio, this is the last of the 10 places to which the Sanhedrin exiled itself. It went last from Sipori to Tveria. It remained in Tveria until it would disband a little over 100 years later. Now, that itself diminished its status. Remember I said the Babylonian Jews no longer accepted it. When the seat of the Sanhedrin was severed from the seat of the Nasi remained in Sipori. Sanhedrin moved, then already the Sanhedrin status was less than it was. But the Torah taught by Rabbi Yochanan was instrumental in producing the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Yerushalmi Talmud, although that would not achieve its final form until the 4th century. Rabbi Yochanan's life, it's impossible to exaggerate, was filled with suffering. The great Rabbi Yochanan, he was born an orphan. His father died while his mother was pregnant. His mother died in childbirth. All 10 of his sons died in his lifetime. The Gemara says he would carry around with him a bone or probably a tooth of his youngest son, Rabbi Menachem Avol, saying, Dein Garma Dasira Ber. This is the tooth of my 10th child. All that remains, and use it to comfort others. He also lived in crushing, abject poverty his entire life, no different than anyone else in his generation, except for a brief time in mid-century when the economy picked up and Jews naturally began to chase after luxuries, which they were criticized by Rabbi Yochanan. But because of his stature and his circumstances, his Torah was especially prized and lauded by Chazal, his physique as well. The Gemara notes that he had a beautiful physical appearance, notwithstanding his poverty, and notwithstanding the fact, the Gemara says, that he was clean-shaven. He didn't have a beard. And yet, even without a beard, they held he was a handsome person. How much more so, the Gemara says, not me. How much more handsome he would have been had he had a beard. Much of the Talmud consists of the disputes of Rav and Shmuel, Abai and Rav from the later generation in Bavel, and Rabbi Yochanan and his brother-in-law and Bar Plukta, Rav Shimon ben Lakish. In fact, you can't go even a few dafim in the Gemara without coming across a machlokas of one of those three pairs. Rish Lakish is the inspiration to Balei Tshuva. The Gemara says in Bamatzia Daf Peidala Mar Aleph, Rish Lakish was renowned as a bandit. He's a thief, a marauder, with prodigious physical abilities. Strong, powerful, leaping abilities that Jews today are not associated with at all. Rabbi Yochanan was once bathing in the Jordan River, and he was assaulted by Rish Lakish. And Rabbi Yochanan said to Rish Lakish, you can try this on a mugger someday, Chelach la'oraisa, you should use your strength for Torah. And Rish Lakish said to him, Shufrach l'nashay, you should use your beauty for women. And they got into a discussion, and then and there Rabbi Yochanan talked him into abandoning his life of crime, into studying Torah, even promising him he'd give him Rabbi Yochanan's sister as a wife if he did that. And sure enough, he did. And he became also a tremendous Talmud Chacham, more a Talmud Chaver of Rabbi Yochanan than just a Talmud. Certainly, it's not a traditional career trajectory in the Torah world that Rish Lakish had. But nonetheless, that's the inspiration to Balei Tshuva. So much so, Murtaz, really a very sharp story. Whatever Rabbi Yochanan would say, Rish Lakish would argue on. He would give him 50 reasons why it was wrong. They'd argue back and forth. When Rish Lakish died, then Rabbi Yochanan was distraught. And Gemara tells a story that Rabbi Yochanan started teaching the Beis Medrash, and the Talmidim, whatever he said, they would agree with, and they would bring him raya that he's right. And Rabbi Yochanan said, I need you for that. I wish I had Rish Lakish who could argue with me, and then we're able to explicate the Torah fully, just to tell me that I'm right. Who needs that? That was the relation of Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish. And yet, despite that, despite the Torah, the Talmud Torah, it was a time of terrible turmoil. Rome still ruled Israel with an iron fist, but found itself in three separate wars with King Shapur, Shur Malka, losing wars at that. Rome was on the decline. Jews in Bavel and Israel were on separate sides, opposite sides in these wars, but of course Jews never fought in the Roman army at that point. We're no longer fighting in the Roman army at that point. Throughout the century, the Romans harassed the Jews of Israel in one celebrated, infamous case. They banned the observance of Yom HaKippur. It's the Gemara Chulin, Daf Kuf Aleph, Amud Beis. And Chazal ruled that year they would shift the day of Yom HaKippur to Shabbos, because the Romans knew anyway they were not working on Shabbos, and that's what they did. Shasat Chag. They changed the Yom Kippur from the day it was on to Shabbos, so the Romans would not be suspicious seeing no one working, and they'd be able to fast anyway. With it all, Jewish life stabilized. In the 3rd century of the Common Era, when Rabbi Yochanan died in the year 288, his yeshiva in Tveria existed, thrived, the Mesorah was secure, and the second generation of the Amoraim had come to a close. In summary, the 3rd century saw several major and enduring changes in Jewish life. The center shifted to the exile from Eretz Yisrael, and would not soon shift back. More Jews lived abroad, far more Jews than in Israel. The Torah leadership in Golus became autonomous and independent, no longer subservient to the scholars of Eretz Yisrael. The Nasi, as the single recognized head of the Jewish people in Israel, declined in significance and influence, and the Golus itself slowly and steadily began to lose its negative connotations, but rather be perceived as a legitimate, even positive, even affirmative expression of God's will. Great figures like Rav indelibly shaped our world, put the final touches on our Siddur and our Machzor. Shmuel, Rav Yochanan, and others, Rav Yehuda, Rav Huna, and Rav, of course, began fashioning the Talmud of the future. It was a mostly tranquil century, relatively, of course. The 4th century would see the rise of new forces, especially an aggressive Christianity that would wreak havoc on the Jews of Israel and on our history until today. I thank you all very much.